From the studios of WRPI in Troy, New York, this is Little Brother, the show where we talk about high technology, low intelligence, what happens when you mix the two, and where, like any responsible little brother, we tell on Big Brother. My name is Chuck Ritter, and I'll be your host for the next hour. This is episode number 23 of Little Brother, dated the 6th of October, 2001. Stay tuned, Little Brother is right around the corner. Thank you for tuning in and being part of our show. Before we get started, need to remind all of the listeners that the opinions and views expressed in this program are strictly those of the participants, not necessarily those of the WRPI staff or management, Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute, or the Rensselaer Student Union. If you'd like to contribute your opinion, please feel free to do so by calling us at area code 518-276-6248. Or, if you'd rather not speak it yourself, you can always send us an email. Email address is critter@verizoneatspoop.com. That email address again is critter, C-R-I-T-T-E-R, @verizoneatspoop.com. Lastly, if you'd rather send us snail mail, you can do that too. My snail mail address is Little Brother, care of WRPI, 1 WRPI Plaza, Troy, New York, 12180. Phone number again is 518-276-6248. Due to an interesting scheduling fluke this particular week, I've ended up with two programs. So what will happen is we're going to go through our an abbreviated form this afternoon. If you like what you hear here now, please tune in this evening at 7 o'clock for a reprise. And following in our usual technique, we're going to start by bringing you some selections from the Risks Digest. The Risks Digest can be found on the internet by accessing the comp.risks news group, or you can find it at its home website of catlis.ncl.ac.uk. That's catlis, as in minus feline, .ncl.ac.uk/risks. First item comes to us from Peter G. Newman, who is the moderator of SAME. He says, the Risks Forum has long advocated the importance of increased awareness of risks and avoidance of critical systems with too many inherent weak links. On 11th of September 2001, the Internet stood up well and was a very important source of information. Land-based cellular telephone systems experienced major outages in Lower Manhattan. A few companies, such as Cantor Fitzgerald and eSpeed, suffered huge personnel losses, but were nevertheless able to resume operations quickly through various combinations of advanced planning and rapid recovery strategies. There are many lessons that are worth recording here, so I'd like to invite some of you to contribute short but pithy items on what was achieved, what was learned, and what insights you might have gained. If you have any such insights, post them to the comp.risks news group. Let's see here. Bring some more in a second here. Internet experts believe that the threat of cyber attacks are increasing, though not necessarily from Osama bin Laden's Al-Qaeda network, which seems focused on destroying physical targets and killing civilians. Georgetown University computer science professor Dorothy Denning says, it's my understanding that they're not teaching this in terrorist training camps, but rather the danger comes from these thousands of affiliates or sympathizers. Stephen Northcutt, who runs an information warfare simulation for the SANS Institute, warns that terrorists could potentially paralyze commerce and might be able to accomplish a cascading failure of the electronic grid. Monty Solomon submits that hackers face a life imprisonment under the Anti-Terrorism Act. Justice Department proposal classifies most computer crimes as acts of terrorism. Hackers, virus writers, and website defacers would face life imprisonment without the possibility of parole under legislation proposed by the Bush administration that would classify most computer crimes and maybe non-crimes as acts of terrorism. The Justice Department is urging Congress to quickly approve its Anti-Terrorism Act, a 25-page proposal that would expand the government's legal powers to conduct electronic surveillance, access business records, and detain suspected terrorists. Alistair MacDonald submits that the Gartner Group is recommending that Internet Information Server users who have been hit by the recent Microsoft exploits should immediately consider moving to alternatives such as Apache or iPlanet. But when will those in control take note? I'm not sure that a lot of NT or 2000 system administrators, and especially webmasters, are aware of the limitations of their platform, but corporate strategy means they are a, quote-unquote, Microsoft shop. Gary Stock submits that a computer security expert has revealed how he altered news articles posted to Yahoo's website without permission. The incident highlights the danger of hackers posting misleading information to respected news outlets. Freelance security consultant Adrian Lamo demonstrated that only armed with an ordinary internet browser, he could access content management systems used by Yahoo staff to upload daily news. He added the false quotes to stories to prove the whole was real to computer specialist site security Focus. Yahoo has issued a statement saying the vulnerability has been fixed and security is being reviewed, but experts say that the incident demonstrates a serious risk. Just think how much damage you could do by changing the quarterly results of a company in a story, according to J.J. Gray, a consultant with Computers Consultants at Stake. Yet another attack on Hotmail. Computing reports that one can hack the Hotmail website and redirect users to another site. This brings up the possibilities of password collecting. The hacker, known as Oblivion, reported this to the BugTrack mailing list. The exploit involves smuggling JavaScript code through the filters used at Hotmail. If you have any thoughts on any of these items, please give me a call. 518-276-6248 is the phone number here, and I'd like to hear from you. Let's see. Cryptologic Incorporated, a Canadian online casino games developer that has been hacked. One of their sites has been fixed so that the craps and video slot players could not lose, with winnings totaling $1.9 million. Every dice throw turned up doubles, and every slot spin generated a perfect match. Whether it was an insider attack or a penetration is not clear from the article. The 20-year-old creator of the Kurnikova virus, JW from Sneak, was sentenced to 150 hours of community service by the court Leerwarden this Thursday. The prosecution demanded a maximum of 240 hours of community service. In February, DW released on the Internet the so-called warm virus, which spread itself as an email message. The virus was activated by clicking the email, which was titled Anna Kurnikova. This led to the inconvenience of Internet users all over the world. When determining the sentence, the court took into consideration that the boy had no previous run-in with justice, that he had turned himself in, and that material damages were limited. The American Investigation Service, FBI, reported an amount of $166,827 in damages. Let's see, last week we spoke about Brian West. We'll just do a quick recap of his story. It seems like such a straightforward example of prosecutorial misconduct. An Oklahoma man was being investigated by the Justice Department for helping a newspaper fix a website security hole. The outcry among the geek community last month began with an uncritical story on LinuxFreak.org entitled Cyber Citizen Lands Felony Charges. Sites such as Slashdot soon picked up the sad tale of 24-year-old Brian K. West as evidence of out-of-control, tech-clueless government lawyers, and urged everybody to email the U.S. attorney in charge of the prosecution. Making the story even more appealing to the open-source community was the Microsoft angle. West said he was said to have reported to the Poto, Oklahoma Daily News and Sun, a security flaw in Microsoft NT 4.0 Information Internet Server and Microsoft Front Page. But a guilty plea that West signed tells a far different story and shows how easily a well-meaning community of programmers and system administrators can be led astray. While probing the site, the defendant made copies of 6 proprietary Perl scripts that were part of the source code running the PDNS web page. The defendant also obtained the source code, also obtained the password files from PDNS, using those passwords to access other parts of the PDNS web page. Defendant electronically shared the scripts and the password files for the PDNS website with another individual. The defendant's access to the web page involves interstate communication. Yet another case of media putting a spin on something that isn't necessarily appropriate, and I have to confess and apologize for myself having been roped into that one and probably brought a number of my listeners along with me. Speaking of listeners, are there any out there? If so, give a call, 518-276-6248. Reuters reports that the U.S. District Court in Philadelphia has ordered John Zuccarina to shut down sites operated by him. The Federal Trade Commission filed a complaint against Zuccarina, claiming that he has purchased domain names which are misspellings of or other one-offs of popular sites, which he uses to blitz unsuspecting visitors with pop-up ads, from which the user cannot escape in order to receive advertising revenue, estimated between $800,000 and $1 million. Zuccarina was registered with some 5,500 domains, including www.annakournikova.com, 41 variations of Britney Spears, and others. Yesterday, September 10th, the U.S. Transportation Department released a report on the vulnerabilities of the global positioning system. The report can be obtained from www.navcen.usc.gov/gps/geninfo/pressrelease.htm. I'll put a link up to that on my website, www.tricityads.com, later on so that you can find it. All right, I'm going to take a quick 5-minute break here, and we will be right back. You're listening to Little Brother on WRPI Troy.
And come.
And we're back. The program you're listening to is Little Brother. Topic is technology, and your opinions are welcome at 518-276-6248. The hospitals in Västra Götaland, Sweden, West Coast, population 1 million, were isolated from the internet during the 23rd of September 2001. Some of the internal networks had to be partitioned in order to prevent NIMDA from spreading further. Reservations and computer-based medical records were unavailable. The fact that a hospital chain has so relaxed the security is amazing. It's also amazing that the whole organizations are kept hostage of a vendor that's not even cost-effective. This is, of course, a reference to Microsoft. What would happen if we ever got a real threat to security? Now, I'm sure most of you have thought at this point in time that Y2K is gone now that the actual year is behind us. And the following one is most of the way behind us, for that matter. But the Y2K problem is being blamed for incorrect Down syndrome results being given to more than 150 pregnant women throughout northern England between January and May. As a result, four Down syndrome pregnancies went undetected. Amongst other factors, the mother's age is used to assess her risk category. Only those in the high-risk category undergo further tests for the syndrome. Staff noticed some strange results coming from the system, but initially thought they were due to a different mix of women being tested. Oh, let's see. Some months ago, we spoke about an oxygen tank at Westchester Medical Center had gotten too close to an MRI machine, and when the MRI machine was fired up, the oxygen tank became projectile and killed a six-year-old boy. Well, they have now been fined $22,000 for 11 violations related to that death. And hopefully they won't. They'll be a little bit more attentive to this sort of problem. Let's see here. We'll take a second here and find out what we're going to do next. Looks like what we're going to do next is take a phone call. Hello, caller. You're on Little Brother.
Oh, WRBI?
Yes, sir.
Yes. I just want to ask a question about programming. I thought I heard New Dimensions on yesterday, and I thought that was on Thursday in the afternoon. Have they moved it now or what?
There has been some programming changes. I can't. I don't have a schedule right in front of me, so I can't really speak to them right at the moment.
Could I have one sent to me?
I could probably arrange that. Can you? Let me take. You're on the air right now. Let me take you off, and I will.
I didn't realize.
That's quite all right. It happens. Unfortunately, it happens quite frequently.
Okay.
But yes, I'll take you off the air, and I'll get to you in. You wouldn't mind holding for about 10 minutes, would you?
Maybe I should call back after 2.
You could do that if you want.
Okay. Well, what is today's topic anyway? As long as I butted in here.
Okay. This is a technology show. And we talk mostly about how technology interacts, how high technology and low intelligence interact, and that's kind of the humorous take on it. But the fact of it is, primarily talk about negligence and electronic civil rights.
Oh, okay. Is this kind of in the wake of September 11th, I presume, or just kind of more generally?
No, actually, this show has been around in one form or another for almost a year now.
Okay.
And we did do a couple of discussions on around the events of the September 11th. But what is happening is since there's no football game today, I'm on the air now, where normally I would be on at 7 o'clock this evening. And actually, I will also be on at 7 o'clock this evening.
Oh, okay. That's interesting. If you got a minute there, I got a couple thoughts I could throw sort of in that direction.
Go right ahead. I mean, the phone lines are open for a reason.
Oh, okay, great. I'm kind of very interested in low-tech things. With the interest in you know, I think in many ways people are kind of all gaga over a lot of high-tech things, and in many ways sometimes low-tech is the cheapest or simplest or most, you know, most pertinent way to go given a certain situation.
Mm-hmm.
And so... actually, no, maybe this is a case of low intelligence on my part here, but I was thinking of some of the aspects of the World Trade thing in terms of people getting out of the building. So the elevators are shut down, and all the people do have is stairs. And has anybody called in with any thoughts about that? I had thoughts about, wouldn't there be a way, or maybe would this be an interesting project for maybe even some RPI students to work on, is creating a set of slides that could be stored perhaps even underneath a given set of stairs that could be somehow rolled into position where they would be like a slide per each floor, and people could slide down per floor and then just walk a couple steps and slide the next floor, which would be a lot faster, could be done in good volumes, and it would also address the questions of people being injured, disabled, or ill that could be transported. You heard a lot of stories about people having to be carried on somebody else's back or maybe even being left there and stuff. I don't know. I wonder if there's any discussion that happened on, you know, building design in the wake of that kind of a, for, you know, just one more way to address the whole emergency situation.
Actually, oddly enough, no, there wasn't any discussion of that. Although if we go back to the start of your comment there, you're right. People do go gaga over the high tech, and we as a nation have a tendency to throw a lot of high tech solutions at problems that are really not a high tech problem. And dealing with the Al Qaeda is certainly not a high tech problem because they are not high tech people.
Exactly. Yeah, I think that's one of the big lessons of that is to, you know, we could take existing solutions that are not gaga, not like putting on, like, say, the anti-missile defense or something, but something that can be, you know, pretty readily available. And there certainly are places where high-tech would be the way to go, but there's a lot of places where low-tech is overlooked, and that's something I think that needs to be brought into discussions of this sort, and with good examples of that, too. One more little tidbit. I remember an article I read years ago in the Smithsonian Magazine that mentioned a lot of different low-tech things that are happening in the world that, you know, might be surprising. Like, for example, water buffalo, for example, are more effective than tractors in mud. They're lower cost, and they deal with deeper and messier mud conditions than, say, any tractors would, you know, in certain third-world situations, and just as one example. So
yeah, and you're absolutely right. Now on the other front, honestly, I don't believe that folks have really given much consideration at all to the prospect of how to escape from a skyscraper. And the World Trade Center is not, or was not, the only skyscrapers around. I think that even lower ones such as the even the Corning Tower here in Albany. I don't think that there's a maybe there is and maybe there isn't an adequate escape plan for the building. But on the face of it, if you really thought about it, and you thought about the prospect of what if somebody did something to the building that destabilized it, how would you get out?
Yeah, right.
And I think that the only portion of that that in the case of the World Trade Center was given any thought. Was when the architect designed the building, he designed it so that should it collapse, it would go straight down, and that is exactly what it did.
Yeah.
Which at least spares you the casualties from the surrounding area.
Right.
I like the slides idea. I like that. They do equip planes with them for
right, exactly.
After a landing, mm-hmm. for after a difficult landing.
Yeah. I thought of some way if it could be, because, you know, retrofitting it into existing buildings, of course, besides designing into new buildings, and that way they would have to be stored in some kind of way underneath the above stairs, but somehow able to be slid or rolled or assembled in a position with some very simple maneuvers. And then again, my first thought was having like a continuous slide, but that would be hard. You know, people would get faster and faster, and that wouldn't work. So it would have to be probably broken up floor by floor, so people couldn't accelerate too fast, and could, you know, if people floor by floor could get on.
Yeah, actually, the thought that had first crossed my mind when you were talking about alternative escapes was a fire pole, and I immediately scratched that one because, as you say, you'd get going too fast.
Right, yeah, and then and you'd have to be fairly strong to grab on in the first place, and what if you missed, or, you know, I mean, there wouldn't be, you'd have to be in good physical shape, and it could only work for a couple of floors, and you'd have to have gloves and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
So that would be the other way, and again, I also was pleased to know that it would help in the case of people that are disabled or otherwise couldn't, you know, handle stairs very well.
Right.
So anyway, I just thought that was a something that people are thinking about. There was a show on one of your, I don't know, sister stations, I guess you could call it, WAMC, a couple of weeks ago where, I'm sorry, I forget the gentleman's name, but someone with, you know, some architectural background that was, you know, talking about how the World Trade was set up and other common features of buildings. We spent an extensive amount of time with callers about how to the steel from, you know, from the high temperatures or let it last longer for people to get up there or, you know, what could be done on that front, too. And that's where they spent a lot of their time.
Yeah. Well, I'll tell you, quite frequently, the problem with a fire situation is not the building itself burning, but rather its contents.
Yes.
Especially you get up into executive offices, you find a lot of wood furniture scattered around the place. Well, not scattered, but you understand what I mean.
Right. Sure.
Especially mahogany. They seem to love that stuff up on on the top floor.
Yeah. Right.
In fact, the place we used to work, we used to lovingly refer to the executive suites as Mahogany Row.
Yeah, right.
But then, of course, if there's any kind of clerical work going on, there's papers scattered all over the place, so those can catch and run.
And there's electrical.
And when somebody comes in and remodels the place, if they remodel the place, how do they remodel the place? Are they how are they choosing the materials that they use?
Mm-hmm.
And I think that that might not be a first consideration right there.
I'm sure it's not. And then you got rugs, too, you know, that cover the whole area, et
cetera. Right.
Well, anyway, well, it's, I'm glad you have this program here. I'm glad I stumbled onto it. I don't want to monopolize the conversation, but thank you. I didn't get your name, though, by the way. And again, the name of the program?
My name is Chuck Ritter. The program is called Little Brother. And until hockey season, I'll be on every Saturday night at 7 o'clock. And after the end of football season, I'll be occupying this slot from 1:30 to 2:30.
Mm-hmm. Okay, great.
Thank you for calling.
You bet.
All right.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye. And on that note, we need to take a moment for a station ID. You're listening to WRPI Troy.
Once again, the staff and management of WRPI proudly present How to Tell WRPI from All the Other Radio Stations Ever.
Reason number 3.14159. Interesting technical information.
Words manifested, disintegrate, particles drift into atoms that separate, developing a movement known as sound waves that travel at Mach 1 by the airspace. The microphone making it vibrate, electrical impulse start to migrate along the wire to enter the next phase, the audio sequence. The infamous noise they lift over the threshold to enter the system. Those matter, not converted to data. Knowledge is primary, communication is digital, language is binary. From the bit to the megabyte, mass is the mode to educate the neophyte, science is the role. The way to understand that a complex network always expanding, grown by the minute. The realm of broadcast, borders of infinite. Signals energized, remaining for transmit, working its way up the tower several times an hour, getting power rotation, zero static from the air. Receivers are fine-tuned, perception is clear, courtesy of fiber optics. The highs are bright, the lows kick.
Join us next time as we bring you more of How to Tell WRPI from All the Other Radio Stations Ever, a seemingly endless saga brought to you as a public service by WRPI in Troy.
You can always bet your bottom dollar dreams are gonna visit you tonight. Cloudy visions of the past and future, throwing shadows on your inner life.
WRPI Troy. Lit Orbital set us a nice gentle groove here for a second. Since the caller brought up the topic of the World Trade Center, let's move forward on that one. Federal Trade Commission Chairman Timothy J. Murris is to announce that his agency will not seek stronger consumer privacy laws. His position is a reversal of Clinton-era privacy that said consumer privacy laws were needed to protect personal data on the Internet. The decision carries more weight after the September 11th terrorist attacks. Since then, many companies have been sharing their consumer data with law enforcement agencies and each other in an attempt to look for suspicious coincidences. Murris will instead increase the staff working on privacy issues by 50%, according to sources familiar with the chairman's plan. The extra people are to enable the commission to police more websites and bring lawsuits against violators. He also plans to target mass email, also known as spam. The FTC will create a national list of companies that are bothering consumers by sending excessive amounts of unwanted commercial email. Several privacy groups expressed their dismay at the FTC's retreat. In a report to Congress last year, the commission calls for laws to make sure consumers know how their data is being collected over the Internet and to allow them to choose how it is used. It's unfortunate that Murris should take this backward step rather than a more progressive step to safeguard consumers, said Sarah Andrews of the Electronic Privacy Information Center. FTC spokeswoman Kathleen McFarland declined to comment on the planned speech to be given to a privacy conference in Cleveland. Murris succeeded Robert Potofsky as the head of the FTC in May. Morris's decision to drop support for new privacy legislation was first reported by the Los Angeles Times in Tuesday editions. Larry Poneman, head of the Richardson, Texas-based Privacy Council, said the decision will be another blow to privacy advocates already smarting over the Justice Department's calls for fewer restrictions on surveillance. If the speech was delivered on September 10th, it would have been viewed as a negative event in the privacy community. Now that it's delivered after the 11th, it's a crisis. It looks like we've lost federal government support. Poneman, a privacy consultant, said that he has been contacted by many companies such as banks and national supermarket chains asking how they should tell customers that they gave huge swaths of customer data to law enforcement. In many cases, Poneman said, the companies sent the information on their own initiative in order to assist the terrorism investigation. Some firms, such as airlines and car rental agencies, are breaking their privacy policies by sharing data to analyze suspicious activity. During the presidential campaign, then-Governor Bush said that he supported Americans' right to know their personal information is collected and how it's used. But since the election, Bush has not had the opportunity to act on any internet privacy legislation. The White House did not immediately return a call seeking comment. Morris went with many advocacy groups in making his decision and made no secret of his reluctance for new laws, according to Ari Schwartz of the Center for Democracy and Technology. He made it very clear he's looking for cases under existing authority to take action. This next item comes to us from New Scientist. This can be found on the web at newscientist.com. The music industry is now testing different copy protection systems on mass market chart CDs, with copies of NSYNC's Celebrity on the Zomba label being sold in at least three different versions. Those available in Germany have draconian protection. A slightly weaker system is used on the U.S. version, and there's no protection on the U.K. version. The only visible clue is a small print on the German release, which warns that the CD may not be playable on computers. Sony will not comment on the NSYNC disc, but a spokesman says, we continue to test available copyright protection technologies, and our goal is to implement copyright protection on a broader basis to deter digital piracy. Sure, I'm aware of it, says Maria Ho in Zomba's New York office, but she had no comment to make by the time of publication. Sebastian Kalik at Zomba's German headquarters would also make no comment. Gillian Midgley of the UK Campaign for Digital Rights said the record companies are using consumers' money to fund their own experiments by throwing different systems onto the market to see who notices, who cares, and what they can run with. Sony presses the German disc at DADC factory in Austria. Sony DADC also developed the Key 2 audio system used to protect promotional copies of Michael Jackson's latest single. All three discs appear to play on consumer CD players, though Super Audio CD players from Philips and Sony took about 30 seconds to recognize the German version. Both the UK and US versions will play on a Windows PC, and both let a PC CD burner make a copy onto a blank CD. But the German version does not even play on a Windows PC, meaning users cannot listen to the music they have bought while they work. It cannot be copied to a blank CD or sent over the internet using a PC. However, Apple Mac users have succeeded in playing the German disc. Copying used home CD recorders is variable, using the US CD giving a no-disc message on some recorders. When the digital output from a CD player is connected to the digital input of a Philips CD recorder or a Sony mini-disc recorder, the German disc gives the error message, copy prohibit, or cannot copy. Although all CD copy protection systems can be defeated, with only slight quality loss by connecting the analog output of a CD player to the analog input of a digital recorder or PC sound card, the convenience of automatic track indexing is forfeited. If you have any thoughts about that, please give a call. 518-276-6248 is the number here at WRPI. You can also send your comments via email to me at critter@verizoneatspoop.com. That email address again is critter, C-R-I-T-T-E-R, at verizoneatspoop, all one word, .com. Lastly, if you'd rather send snail mail, you can do that too. Snail mail address is Little Brother, care of WRPI, 1 WRPI Plaza, Troy, New York, 12180. Okay. A draft copy protection bill backed by Hollywood heavyweights is triggering an outcry from PC and consumer electronics companies who say the legislation would force them to relinquish control of key systems design technologies. Written by Senator Fritz Hollings of South Carolina, the proposed System Security Standards and Certification Act, or SSSCA, calls for an interactive digital devices to include security technologies certified by the U.S. Secretary of Commerce. If approved, the law would be enforceable under federal regulations and could dramatically alter the way systems, OEMs, and designs design and develop PCs, TVs, set-tops, or other digital appliances with embedded microprocessors, according to industry sources familiar with the Hollings proposal. The motion picture industry, with Disney and Fox Studios in the lead, backs the legislation. This is the best way to protect America's valuable creative works, which in turn will expand broadband access and Internet use, says Jack Valenti, the president of the Motion Picture Association of America. But the PC and consumer electronics OEMs are lining up in opposition to the legislation, which is expected to be the subject of a hearing in late October before a Senate committee chaired by Hollings. The regulatory system is not constructed to deal with digital product design. It only adds an extra layer of complication, said Washington telecommunications attorney James Berger, who works closely with the U.S. computer industry. The bill's broad definition of applicable devices and its blank check approach to federal development of the standards are said to be two major concerns. This is a big bill backed by big companies with big properties. This could change forever the way you and I watch TV over the next 25 to 50 years, warned a consumer electronics executive who asked not to be identified. Vendors fear the bill could hobble system OEMs and consumers by tightly circumscribing the way airwave broadcasts are enabled, watched, and recorded and played back. We're not in the business of making a video recorder to give Disney the authority to turn it off, said another consumer electronics executive based in Washington. Hollings Senate Commerce Science Transportation Committee postponed a hearing on the security legislation until late in October. The legislation reportedly stems from the studio's frustration with a lack of consensus thus far amongst content owners, PC makers, and consumer electronics vendors on copy protection. Talks have dragged on for several years, and some movie studios blame the slow digital TV rollout on the absence of such an agreement, a problem they now believe Congress should rectify. Some security technology experts question the soundness of copy-protected concept itself. Copy protection doesn't work, period, said Bruce Schneier, Chief Technology Officer for Counterpane Internet Security Incorporated and author of Secrets and Lies, Digital Security in a Networked World. The only hope the media companies have is to push the protection into the hardware. This works marginally better, hence the new bill. Schneier also conjured the specter of control, saying he believes the entertainment industry is trying to turn your computer into an internet entertainment console where they, not you, have control over your hardware and software. The bill's draft language would make it unlawful to manufacture, import, offer to the public, provide, or otherwise traffic in any interactive digital device that does not include and utilize certified security technologies that adhere to system security standards. It does not specify the types of technologies or how or when they should be applied, but it does list the criteria to which the technology should adhere, including reliability, renewability, resistance to attack, ease of implementation, modularity, and applicability to multiple technology platforms. The bill would give the private sector 12 months to agree on a standard or empower the Commerce Secretary to step in. If the industry forges an agreement with the deadline, the Commerce Department would turn it into regulation. If not, the National Institute of Standards and Technologies would determine systems security standards. The proposed legislation defines security system technologies broadly enough to include almost any security measures from bit-level and wired-level protection to platform and environment-level security, according to industry sources. There is evidence, however, that several Hollywood studios are already considering the insertion of watermarks carrying certain copy control information in the content released for digital broadcast over the airwaves. Current digital consumer electronics systems are not under obligation to conform to the specific conditional access approach since they are designed to receive free TV broadcasts, but industry sources said that the studios want the makers of such systems to install mechanisms to recognize these proposed studio watermarks. In July, Warner Brothers and Sony Pictures Entertainment agreed to use digital transmission content protection spec from Digital Transmission Licensing Administrator But MPAA members, Disney, Fox, Universal, MGM, and Paramount, complained that the DTCP spec lacked rigor. They sent a proposal to DTLA asking that a watermark copy control information recognition mechanism be added, according to DTLA President Michael Ayers. One official familiar with the DTLA activities asserted that, at a time when we are still sorting out such issues, it's highly improbable or inappropriate for the movie studios to take an action to let the Congress steamroll it. Even if a watermark scheme is introduced, DTLA sources question whether DTCP spec is the right place to implement it. The DTLA and its members' companies are certainly interested in pursuing Congress' goal on inter-industry solutions, said Ayers, but he questioned the wisdom of asking technology companies to stretch their already limited resources for copy protection development all the way to Washington. Okay, folks, this is stupidity. Basically, what they are saying here is that when you get your nice, shiny, new digital TV that we're all going to end up with one of these days, and of course the rollout is running a bit slower than people expected, but they are in the stores and people are buying them from time to time, and you get your nice digital VCR or your DVD recorder to go with it, and you hook it up, whoever's transmitting the movie has the right to tell your DVD recorder to turn off. Interesting thought, isn't it? If they're really concerned about finding out where something came from, what they really should be doing rather than that is they should be doing what they already are doing. It doesn't really matter what TV station you tune to anymore, what network on the cable system you tune to anymore. Somewhere on your screen, there's likely to be a brand. As a for instance, everybody who watches TV in the Capital District is familiar with WRGB's logo, Channel 6. It's a stylized 6 against a gradient maroonish dark red background circle. And what they do throughout the entire course of their broadcast day, this logo appears in the lower right-hand corner of the screen. And it's very obvious if you videotape content from that channel that that is the channel from which you videotape the content. And it seems like most of the cable networks do the same thing. So if that's the case, then why on earth do we need this? I don't understand it. Your opinions are welcome. 518-276-6248 is the number here at WRPI. I'd like to hear from you. With about 10 minutes to go in the show, we're going to be wanting to try to wrap it up. So if you want to throw your opinion in, time's a-wasting. Aside from that, let's see what else we got going on here. Okay, here's one I think is important. Been a lot of discussion of Microsoft security and what an oxymoron it is in recent months. We have a caller. Let's see what we have here. Hello, caller. You're on the air.
Oh, that thing that you're talking about in the corner of this TV station is called a bug.
It's called a bug. Okay, thank you.
What bug? They have a bug generator. You can buy them now for your own station.
Right.
Yep.
Now I ask you, doesn't that make it very obvious if you videotape the content from a TV station? Doesn't it make it very obvious where the content came from?
Yeah, because that's a non-removable thing unless you digitize it out, which would be a lot more effort.
It would be probably a few hundred dollars worth of work in time investment in trying to get the bug out.
Probably more like thousands.
Thousands, okay, fair enough. Well, I'm thinking from the angle of a hobbyist going at it, really.
A hobbyist wouldn't bother.
Okay, fair enough. Fair enough. But as opposed to going out and spending hundreds or even less on the material itself.
Right. It would make more sense to buy a legitimate copy of whatever.
That's what I'm getting at. That's exactly what I'm getting at.
Right.
And they're talking about all of these digital watermarking techniques, and I don't quite understand why.
Just something to make them feel better about their own security, apparently.
Well, obviously, they do feel rather insecure. I agree with you.
You're never gonna stop anybody from taping what they're gonna tape anyway. And I mean, they're gonna do it whether they have the bug or whether they have the security. As for every security feature they come out with, somebody comes out with an override. So.
Well, the thing I find interesting is that the advent of digital TV has brought about a way to prevent the signal from going from digital into an analog state and then recording the analog signal at the increased resolution. I did an article some months ago where there was... I want to say it was DirecTV, but I'm not absolutely certain about it. Had a receiver that was capable of picking up HDTV broadcasts from satellite. And anytime a particular flag was set on the HDTV signal, this flag would cause the analog output of that particular receiver to blank out, or either blank out or knock down to the standard resolution. I forget which it was.
Right.
Making it unusable with HDTV monitors.
Yeah, I have heard of that. I'm not sure which network it was either, but I have heard of it.
Mm-hmm. Now, may I ask, you knew the name of that right off the bat. Are you are you a videophile or in the video business?
Yeah, a little bit. I kind of freelance for some couple of places around the area.
Fair enough. Okay. I was just curious what angle you were coming at this from.
Yeah.
All right.
They do have macro. They used to have that macro vision. You see that on the videotapes. They do have that for CDRs and DVDs now, but not as many people seem to be using it.
It is still there. I know that. Are you there?
Yep. That's another expensive thing to get into.
Yeah, I know that is still there. Actually, macro vision is not that difficult to defeat. I think that's
right.
Probably why they've kind of allowed it to go by the wayside.
Right, right.
I had an observation in setting up a mini satellite system for my neighbor that when we hooked the analog output, you know, he just had the standard resolution one, the NTSC resolution version, and I noticed that when we hooked it up through his VCR, that quite frequently it would behave as if MacroVision were being used on the particular program content.
Mm-hmm.
And what really irritated the heck out of me was that amongst the program content that this happened to were the actual menus and setup screens on the converter, on the receiver.
Mm.
So as we were trying to configure the receiver, all of a sudden the screen would go blank.
Yeah. It was getting a false reading from the signal generator. That's what
exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Hmm. But I know they have developed ways around MacroGuard and MacroVision too. So there's, it'll be just a couple more years before somebody comes out with something.
Oh, I'm sure of it. I mean,
yeah.
The standing wisdom for a long time has been whatever man can lock up, man can unlock.
Right.
It's just a question of how much effort are you willing to put into it. And how much effort are you willing to put into locking it in the first place? And how much inconvenience are you willing to put the legitimate user through? And
right.
Quite frankly, the inconvenience threshold for your typical television viewer is pretty low.
Mm-hmm.
If they can't watch it, they're going to watch something else.
Right. That's it.
All right.
Okay.
Well, right. I appreciate the call, and I appreciate you listening, too.
No problem. Thanks.
Well, take care. All right, and let's see. We're coming up against the end of the show here, so I think that what I'm going to do is just cut to some music real quick and see if I can't locate the next host. You've been listening to Little Brother, episode 23, for the 6th of October 2001, and my name is Chuck Ritter, and I will see you down the road.